Welcome to Gospel Tangents. I'm Dan Vogel.
Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. There are very few prophets who claim to have seen God, Joseph Smith and Moses. So in our next conversation, we'll talk about this unique experience. Or was it unique? It turns out that many Methodists of Joseph Smith's day had visions. Is Joseph Smith's vision unique? Historian Dan Vogel will answer that question in our next conversation. I hope you check it out. I'd also like to ask you to please subscribe on our website. Click the yellow subscribe button at gospeltangents.com and you can help keep this podcast alive. Now back to our conversation. So let me ask a question here, because I believe I've heard this before, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Methodists a lot of times had these similar sorts of visions of Jesus. And so in one sense, Joseph's vision was not unusual.
No.
Can you talk a little bit more about those Methodist experiences?
Well, yeah, people at the revivals, especially Methodist ones, would get religious enthusiasm, as they called it. They would get all excited, and some people would have heavenly visions. Some people would see Jesus. A lot of ministers at the time, forget about the revivals, a lot of ministers at the time, when they wrote their autobiographies, would write about their conversion story, and it would include seeing Jesus. Experience with deity in some form. A born-again type experience. This is what I would suggest that Joseph Smith really had. We'll eventually get to that, and that the story evolved over time. So I'm unlike Wesley Walters, unlike a lot of critics.
Wesley Walters is a critic. And isn't he a Methodist, if I remember right?
He was a Presbyterian minister.
Presbyterian
minister, and when he found out there was no 1820 revival, he admitted that you can't prove that a vision didn't take place, because that's an inward experience, and it's not open to historical analysis, but I say it is. you can't say whether Joseph Smith didn't have a real experience of some kind, but you can say that that story evolved. So you can make a case for that. So that which is what I do. I don't deny that Joseph Smith had an experience in 1820 or 21. The 1832 account says it was in 1821. You know, in his 16th year, when he was 15. The 1838 account says in his 15th year, when he was 14. which becomes important when I try to reconstruct what may have actually happened. The core story that evolved over time for different audiences and different purposes. So the 1832 account is more concerned with Joseph Smith repenting of his sins. And this is where it conflicts with the 1838 account. The 1838 account, he doesn't know which church is true. There's a revival. He's confused over which church to join. So he goes to pray to see which church to join. The father and son appear, tell him that they're all creeds are an abomination in his sight, and to join none of them. The 1832 account has Joseph Smith concluding that all the churches are false at the age of 12. And like his parents, Lucy and Joseph Smith Sr. had both made the same conclusion, that all the churches were false. But it wasn't tied to they didn't have authority. They were just corrupted by the traditions of men. No one's thinking of, they don't have priesthood authority, because Christians didn't think that way. Catholics did. But Protestants didn't think of, we have authority and the Catholics don't, or whatever. Protestants got their authority to baptize, let's say, because the Bible commanded that you be baptized. And that is the authority, the commandment coming from the Bible. Whereas Joseph Smith said, no, it has to come from revelation. So when the angel commands to baptize, you know, or you got a revelation through the stone to baptize, that is a new revelation and that is the new authority. So he has current authority, current revelation. That is the original concept of authority before there were any stories of angelic ordinations. But in the 1832 account, Joseph Smith is told, Joseph Smith has already concluded there's no church. So when he goes to pray, he's not asking which church is true. He's asking, how am I going to be saved? There's no true church. They're all apostate. And what am I to do? And Jesus appears and says, basically confirms his belief that the world is lieth under sin and all that, and says that those who believe on my name shall be saved. So it's very close to a revival experience. You have faith in Jesus and you're saved.
Almost a born again kind of an experience.
That's what I say. Yeah. That's what I say is if you take Jesus out of it, it would be a born again experience.
Okay.
So, why does he have to see Jesus?
You think he basically in 1820 or 21 did have a born again experience?
Yes.
Okay.
His father, Joseph Smith Sr., was a universalist. Okay. And he was probably also a Unitarian because they were one and the same at that time. There are very few people actually separated those two things. They're so close that later in the 19th century, Unitarians and Universalists join. And the texts at the time by Unitarians were Universalists. So, a Unitarian doesn't believe that Jesus is God. He's the Son of God, the same as anyone else can become the Son of God. He's a manifestation of God to show us a perfect example kind of a thing. But he's not God himself. And they're two different people. There's the God the Father, and then there's the Son, not a God. Okay? So, and that's why the Book of Mormon is so preoccupied against universalism. And occupied with obeying the commandments, and that Jesus is the very eternal God.
And this is because Joseph Sr. was a universalist.
And so my take on this is that in 1820 or 21, whenever it happened, he got converted to Jesus, and he liked Methodism.
Okay. And had a Methodist vision experience.
A born-again experience. However, after the church was organized, he needed to have a vision of Jesus before the church was organized in order to be in the apostle.
So you don't think he saw Jesus in 1820?
No, I don't.
It was just a
born-again experience.
Born-again experience, okay.
And I justify that with a little literary criticism of the Book of Mormon, because I believe there's parts of it are autobiographical. And so I would argue that Mormon, in the Book of Mormon, Mormon's the editor of the Book of Mormon. I mean, he's basically Joseph Smith, you know, editing and commenting on other prophets. So in the Book of Mormon, he actually introduces himself in 3rd Nephi as an apostle of Jesus Christ. But Joseph Smith doesn't really get the connection between seeing Jesus and being an apostle. Okay, William E. McClellan, or whatever. He didn't know about the first vision. Well, actually, a lot of members didn't either, because it hadn't been, Joseph Smith didn't publish the 1832 account. He published the 1838 account in 1842, and McClellan was gone. So he must have missed the first vision, because later in years he said, well, how could Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery be apostles at the foundation of the church when they never claimed to have seen Jesus?
What year is this?
When McClellan said that?
Yeah.
Oh, about 1870s.
Oh, it was way after.
Way after, yeah. Okay. So the point is that even when Oliver Cowdery, when the Quorum of the Twelve was organized in February 1835, Cowdery said, your ordinations won't be complete until you see Jesus. So that had become the distinguishing feature of being in the Quorum of the Twelve. So in 1832, the 1832 account, has Joseph Smith seen Jesus? This would be the first time that we know of that he said anything, because the Articles and Covenants didn't say anything.
Yeah, up until then it had only been Moroni, right?
Only Moroni, yes. That people, when you started to talk about the significance of Joseph Smith's church, it always started with Moroni, and revealing of the plates. The interesting thing also is that the 1832 account ends with Oliver Cowdery coming and becoming a scribe for Joseph Smith in April of 1829. And it says that Cowdery had come to Joseph Smith because the Lord had appeared to him,
to Oliver,
and showed him the plates. Probably in a dream. I think that's what it means. Both Joseph and Oliver in the 1832 account see Jesus before the founding of the church. Okay. So I think that's one of the motivations there. The other motivation for the 1832 account is that it starts with announcing Joseph Smith's, why he's the leader of the church, basically, because he's because of the manifestation, receiving a remission of his sins, and then the angel appearing to him, and then having the lesser, or the holy priesthood, it's called the holy priesthood, through the ministering of angels, which you shouldn't assume that means John the Baptist, because the ministering of angels is Moroni. So through the ministering of angels, he receives the holy priesthood. Then the revelation of the high priesthood in June 1831. And so it kind of gives his authority. And the reason why I think it's preoccupied with authority and giving the same rundown as a preamble of the Articles and Covenants, basically, is because he's just returned from Missouri. And in Missouri, Bishop Edward Partridge is giving him a hard time about authority. So there's a challenge to Joseph Smith's overall authority over the whole church. So I think the 1832 account was begun to as a response to challenges to Joseph Smith's leadership. Soul leadership. Bishop Edward Partridge thought he was the leader of the Missouri Church, and was giving Joseph Smith a hard time, and Singer Rigdon had to reprimand Edward Partridge. That's a whole story in itself.
Okay, so I'm glad you mentioned that. I didn't mean to. This brings up another thought, because I had a chat with Michael Marquardt, and actually Michael Quinn as well, because I believe Quinn has three different dates for the restoration of the Melchizedek priesthood, 1829, 1830, and 1831. Uh-huh. Do you have an idea as to when the Melchizedek priesthood was restored? Because it sounds like it's related here to this first vision.
Yeah, so the Melchizedek priesthood, that term, Melchizedek priesthood, is gets a little murky because in June 1831, it says that with the high priesthood, for the first time, the Melchizedek priesthood was revealed. So
in 1831.
June 1831. For the first time, you know, when he's revealing the high priesthood. Now, the Peter, James, and John story is a fiction. It never happened. What happened was the first authority to baptize came through the stone, according to Lucy Smith, in May, 15th of May, 1829, on the day that they baptized one another. And the command was the authority. Nothing about ordination, you know, laying on of hands of angels and things like that. So the that all this ordination by angels comes in 1834 and 1835. But before that, the concept of authority was the command by the through the stone, through the angel, through revelation. The command was authority. And so the first one was the baptism. That was authority. The second one was in the chamber of David Whitmer, Peter Whitmer's, David Whitmer's father's house, where the voice of the Lord in the chamber of Peter Whitmer's house, DNC 128, I believe it is a letter, 1842 letter of Joseph Smith, calling back on various revelations and visions, and he mentions that. And the history of the church mentions it also. So the command in the chamber to ordain one another elders, and that was all. They were made elders. Then, and the eldership was associated with apostleship. It was a different concept of apostle that would come in 1835. Then the next one is the high priesthood in June 1831. Then in September of 1834 is when Oliver Cowdery writes a letter to the Missouri Church, to W.W. Phelps, and tells them that an angel appeared on the day that they baptized, he and Joseph Smith baptized one another. The angel is unnamed, ordained them together to have the authority to baptize.
Who we now know as John the Baptist. Is that right?
You're right. And okay. Joseph Smith names the angel. So Cowdery has no name. It's an angel. Gives them the authority to baptize. Then in 1835, in the early part of 1835, up to probably August of 1835, they're preparing to publish the 1835 Doctrine and Covenants, which is released in September of 1835. Well, Joseph Smith expands earlier revelations, very key revelations, especially on priesthood. And in section 27, or section 27 now, which was originally given in I believe it's September 4th, according to the Book of Commandments, September 4th, 1830, in Harmony, Pennsylvania, when their Newell Knight is visiting Justice and Emma Smith. They're going to get wine for the sacrament. The revelation comes and says that you don't have to use wine, especially from your enemies. And Joseph Smith expands that and says, adds a bunch of poetic kind of, you shall drink the wine in the kingdom with Moroni, and it names, and then it, with John, whom I have sent, you know, and ordained you. And then it mentions Peter, James, and John, whom I have sent, who gave you, has given you the keys of the apostleship. So Peter, James, and John, it gives no date for this appearance. This is the first mention.
So this is 1835?
1835. Okay. Somewhere probably in March or April, I would say, because that's the date the Joseph Smith papers have given for expansions to DNC 107. So
107 is where Peter, James, and John...
No, have. 107 is that expands the 1831 revelation on making the president of the... Joseph Smith, president of the high priesthood, and which is over the bishop. So that was expanded to talk about two priesthoods, you know.
Okay.
And so some other things.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with historian Dan Vogel. In the early days of the church, many people could receive revelations. And Dan will talk more about how that changed under Joseph Smith.
Eventually, this is where I get into the sociologist Max Weber, a German sociologist who wrote sociological works on from charisma to institution. And he tried to show the transition from charismatic groups, and in order to survive, because charisma is very volatile, because anybody can get a revelation and challenge the leader. How does he maintain his leadership? And over time, it has to transition to the charisma of office. So now I'm the president. Well, Joseph Smith wasn't president of the church until November of 1831. President of the high priesthood. The actual president of the church really doesn't come until even later than that.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please support Gospel Tangents and become a subscriber. For just $5 a month, go to patreon.com/gospeltangents and you can hear the entire interview. And you can also get transcripts available at either our Amazon website, or if you want to give the money to me and not Amazon, please subscribe on my website at gospeltangents.com and you can click the yellow subscribe button. Of course, we're also on Facebook, Twitter, and all the other places. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. And don't forget to click here to subscribe on YouTube, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again for listening.